Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
You can think of evangelists, if you're really looking at it from a marketing standpoint, is like typically like a low cost way of acquiring customers, and typically your customers are developers, versus like more traditional marketing techniques.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Sahn, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, David?
Very happy. For two things. The first thing is sunny today after like 5 days of raining in Costa Rica. It's been very rainy.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that the Costa Rica's soccer team classified to the World Cup.
Yes, I saw that. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. It was tough for me. I did my best.
You did a great job. I saw them give you some credit in the post-match interviews for their number one fan.
We did it. We did it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I know in our company Slack, the company Slack lit up a little bit among the Ticos, the Costa Ricans, after that qualification. And it was really nice, too. We have a very international team at Agility Feet. It was nice to see some of the Panamanians who sadly did not qualify for the World Cup still giving accolades to their Costa Rican teammates. So, yeah, it was definitely a exercise in international diplomacy on our internal Slack.
Absolutely.
During the World Cup.
We have learned the art of being diplomats between us.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, so David, in today's episode, I think we had a really interesting conversation just now with Matt McKay, old friend of mine, the author of Full Stack Python. And he talked with us about a couple of topics, including we spent a lot of time talking about the developer relations role and what he's done with that at Twilio, as well as other side projects, including PlushCap and Full Stack Python. What did you think about the conversation today? What sort of things would you suggest our listeners look out for?
I think it's this kind of interviews or encounters with smart people that bring value to two markets, to the software developers and to the companies. The first part is very much about how a company, particularly that company that has an API as a product, so that the final users are software developers, how they can actually create content to help and create value for the developers, and how that is important for the success of this company. But at the end, we turn towards how a software developer can start this path of creating content for the benefit of the community. So that was a very insightful conversation. I love it. I loved it.
Yeah, I think it was great too. I really appreciated the comments that he made around the importance of empathy and humility when he's hiring for someone in a developer relations role. And it also reminded me of the importance of that in hiring really any senior engineer in your team who has to be able to work with others on the team and be humble and confident in what they know and in teaching others, but also humble in what they still can learn from other people on the team and how they work together too. I think this was a really interesting conversation with Matt. I really enjoyed it. So let's go ahead and get to our interview with Matt McKay. Matt McKay is a brilliant engineer and friend of mine who I'm really happy to have on the Scaling Tech Podcast. He founded Full Stack Python 10 years ago, which is a great place for you to learn more about building, deploying, and operating Python applications. He's also been at Twilio for nearly as long, where he's currently the Senior Director of Builder Content, and he leads teams that bring all of their excellent developer content to their users. Before that, Matt and I first met in grad school when we were both studying for an MS in Management of IT degree. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Matt. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, always good to see you. But let's start. We're going to talk about a number of different topics today, kind of Python, developer relations, anything else you want to touch on as well. We've always had great conversations together. But I want to start with, I imagine the vast majority of our listeners already are familiar with Twilio. But for those who may not be, let's just start with, what does Twilio do and what do you do there?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, I think there's probably plenty of people that are still not that familiar with Twilio. Still a lot of folks that have never used our APIs. Twilio makes it easy for software developers to add communications. So think phone calling, messaging, whether it's WhatsApp or SMS, video, even things like two-factor authentication and email into their applications that they're building. And they can do that with the programming languages and the frameworks that they already know. They don't have to learn a bunch of telecommunications jargon in order to do that. And then they can build great customer experiences on top of that. And that's actually been part of how the company has evolved over the years. For those who are familiar with Twilio, when we started, we really just, you know, communications API. Now we have all sorts of tools that allow you to build those customer experiences on top of that. Tools like Segment, which give you a lot more information about your the customers that you're interacting with.
So I guess maybe it's more appropriate to say those who maybe don't know Twilio by name, although most of our viewers, our listeners are developers, so they're probably familiar with a lot of the most popular APIs out there. But if you're using an app that has like phone calls built into it, like a ride sharing application where you need to talk to the driver, things like that, a lot of times those applications are built on top of the Twilio APIs. So that's kind of, you know, where you are often seen in the marketplace, even if you're not visible necessarily to the end user. I think one of the things that I know about Twilio that you all have a great reputation for as a company is being a really developer-focused company. It's been a really important part of your marketing from the beginning and how you kind of interact and sort of sell yourselves now. So that's where I think developer relations, it's really interesting to see you, the impact you've made in that role and kind of the importance of that role in what Twilio does as a company. Can you kind of explain, you know, what is developer relations?
Yeah, sure. So developer relations is really for companies that want developers to be using their services. And so, you know, it's not actually a common role for like a customer facing company, like a most likely like a Johnson & Johnson is not going to need developer relations. But for typically for like a business to business company, usually where you have some sort of machine to machine interface, typically a REST API, although it certainly could be GraphQL or something like that. You would want developer relations to help gain adoption of your API. So you help developers discover, first off, that there is a solution to a problem that they're having. So with Twilio, for example, it is, you know, developers are like, they'd be like, how do I add two-factor authentication via SMS to their application? And they'd be Googling for it, or they'd meet a developer evangelist and they're like, oh, cool. Like, it seems like Twilio could solve this problem that I'm having. Right. It really tends to be a marketing function where it's the discovery and then the just helping developers figure out how to whether you have the right service, whether you're reliable, whether you're, you know, someone that they want to do business with. And then also that you get the problem that they have, like you understand and you have a good solution to that. So that's a lot of what developer relations is. It's serving developers so that they can use your products and services. As opposed to kind of although it tends to be a marketing function, it's a lot more about when done well, serving developers and making sure that you are a developer, so you get the problems that they're facing and you help them solve those things.
So it's a marketing role, but not marketing, and it's technical documentation in a way, but not technical documentation. It's kind of a combination of a few different skill sets, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually like different ways to run it. I mean, it really depends on what your products and services are. And in fact, like the history of technology evangelism goes back, typically it's thought of as going back to Apple in the 1980s with Guy Kawasaki, and really recognizing that there needed to be an ecosystem of developers that were building applications for, you know, for the Mac. The Macintosh at the time. And so just recognizing the power of like the gravity of having a bunch of developers using your stuff so that, you know, even if it wasn't other developers, it was customers just being able to get access to a new spreadsheet application or, you know, a word processor. Like that was the sort of the nascent origins of technology evangelism, and it evolved over time. And I think has probably taken off a bit more in like the 2010s with a lot of companies like Twilio and Stripe. But there's like a really long list of companies that are out there as well that maybe are just a little bit, you know, were started founded a few years after the like Twilio and Stripe that also do developer relations and you know, developer evangelism. There's a bunch of like kind of terms that I'll have like a little bit of a shade of a different meaning there. And so that's kind of the, you know, the category of what this is. Now, I say it's in marketing. It's not always in marketing. We could probably talk through some of the implications of that, but it tends to be a marketing function because that allows you to align your metrics with something that is important to the business, which, you know, when you're working as part of a business, you got to be powering part of that business, right? So it tends to just align best with marketing for most companies, not necessarily all, but most companies.
Yeah, that makes sense. So for our listeners who tend to be engineering managers of like a growing software development team, they're certainly going to encounter developer relations and developer evangelist roles in the companies that they're working with, the APIs that they're consuming. A lot of those companies are going to have those roles for sure. How do they know if they need that role within their own organization? You know, who need what type of company needs developer relations?
Yeah, that's actually like a different way that I thought you were taking the question. So let's talk about
answer it both ways then. No worries.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, I thought you were going to say like how should engineering managers approach, you know, interacting with companies that have evangelists. But let's touch on what you're asking first. Like, you know, do you need evangelists in your company? Now, again, that can kind of be broken down into two parts. Do you need external evangelists? And some companies have internal evangelists. And so we'll start with external evangelism, because that's really what I do, my colleagues do, which is, you know, we have a business and we interact with other businesses. And we want those businesses to use our APIs, integrate them with their own applications, and use our services. So, you know, if you have some sort of typically a self-service motion, what that means is a developer can go on your website, sign up, does not have to talk to sales. You don't have to spend $100,000 to try it out or get a demo. Like, there's plenty of businesses that are out there and they do that. And if that's how they want to operate, that's fine. But typically evangelism is found for businesses that have a self-service, like, you know, I, as an independent developer, regardless of whether I work at a Fortune 500 company or I'm just building a side project, I can go on a website, I can sign up, I can get access to your, you know, API, and I can start playing around with it and seeing if it fits my needs without spending either any money or just spending a little bit of money. And so typically that's where evangelists come in. You can think of evangelists, if you're really looking at it from a marketing standpoint, is like typically like a low cost way of acquiring customers, and typically your customers are developers, versus like more traditional marketing techniques. Like if you look at, you know, trying to acquire developers via Facebook ads, you know, for some companies that could cost you $500 per customer that you're trying to acquire, depending on your service. Whereas developer evangelism, when done really well, or developer relations, depending on how you, what tactics you use, could be $5, right? It could be two orders of magnitude cheaper to acquire customers. And that really matters for like the unit economics of a business. And so that's for external evangelism. Now, internal evangelists, so you have big companies, I believe a company like Capital One probably has internal evangelists, right? They have tens of thousands of employees, most likely many of them work in IT. And so they probably have internal platforms that they're building to make their developers more productive. And they probably have internal folks that are not ever talking to, you know, a bank's customers, but they're talking to their the developers that work at Capital One, the staff and the consultants that are there, and saying, here's how you use these platforms to be more efficient and productive. And so that's like internal evangelism, which is really just not an area that I'm as you know, familiar with, but that's a different, you know, sort of vein to it. I guess we could touch on the other part, which is what I thought you were going with that question, which is like, if you're an engineering manager at, you know, I don't know, an insurance company, and you're looking at using an API, and you're, you know, like, what do you care about, especially at companies that are, you know, more pragmatic about things and the adoption curve? you don't want to get fired for using some API that is insecure or not providing a good level of service, or just goes out of business for whatever reason and all of your applications stop working, right? So typically, as an engineering manager, you're going to want to look at those, engage with evangelists to just like ask them questions and kind of suss out, like, is this a company that is high quality? Do they really care about developers? Is this API actually the core of their business, or is it just kind of a side tangent, right? So some companies like Netflix had APIs for a long time that they got rid of. It wasn't their business, right? So if you built a whole company on Netflix's API, you don't have a business anymore. You don't, like, it's gone. That's sorry. Like that's the type of thing as an engineering manager that you should be kind of sussing out, is like, is this a legitimate, like any sort of business that you're potentially going to be into, contractual relationship with or something like that. As a supplier, you have to suss out, are they a valid supplier? Are they a good company to do business with? And particularly looking at it as like, should I stake my career on using this vendor or not? Right.
Right.
So fortunately, Twilio's business model is predicated on our APIs. Like, they're not going away. Like, very careful about, deprecation and those sorts of things, because otherwise we don't have customer base. So that'd be a problem for us.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You raise a couple of interesting points there that I hadn't considered. First off, I had no idea that Netflix had APIs in the past, right? Which
years
is
ago,
kind of
yeah.
your point, right? Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely the point. And so what's interesting is this, idea of, if you are an engineering manager looking to consume a company's APIs, then, certainly in the past, I would have looked at their technical documentation as an indicator of how high quality are their APIs, how easy are they to use, that sort of thing. But what you're calling out here too, that's interesting to me, is that the not just the quality of their documentation, but the presence of a developer relations group and how seriously they devote resources to that is a strong indicator to me as an engineering manager of, are they in this for the long haul? Are they really going to be somebody that I want to depend on there? And so that's really interesting. Yeah. So Matt, you were talking about the possibility of an internal evangelist role, which I found interesting in your comments too, that at a larger enterprise, somewhere like a Capital One, for example, that they would have this role that is kind of more like an internal trainer role, perhaps, really for just doing an internal developer evangelism. And in that sort of situation, I know you said this, you're more external facing. It's not necessarily your area of expertise, but maybe that's a role that's more like in an enterprise architecture group rather than a marketing group.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would say it's probably more aligned with the enterprise architecture group. I mean, I do think that it's a role that has evolved because, think about the ability of a single developer to adopt APIs very easily and readily. It's the same thing as like shadow IT. Finance needs a something, so they go and get a SaaS product, right? Like as an enterprise architect, maybe 20 years ago, it was okay to say like, these are the tools we're going to use. That's it. And that there's no other choice, right? Like, you're not going to be able to like go sign a contract behind the scenes to use something else. But today, like with the ready, so with all these APIs, these SaaS products that are readily adoptable, I think the you can't just be like, no. You also have to like, an internal evangelist is one who's going to be like, here's why you should use here. We have a master services agreement with Twilio because that powers the communications, and here's how we make it really easy for you to adopt this. If you internally can make it easier to adopt the companies that you think are that you want your developers to be using, sometimes tens or hundreds of thousands of developers at these large enterprises, that's just going to make everybody's life easier, right? Like, so as opposed to just like by decree saying you must use something, it's more like, here's how you use it. Here's how you make it really easy. Here's why you should be using it. It's definitely, and probably training, as you said, like, is probably a part of the piece as well. But again, not totally my area of expertise, but I kind of feel like a little bit of it is just the changing landscape of the IT industry is kind of forcing a different tone when it comes to, internal platform developer platforms.
Yeah, tone's a key word there, I think, because like an enterprise architect, you tend to think of that as sort of a top-down enforcing regulations type of right. mindset, which obviously has some value in a large enterprise. You need some amount of agreement on how you're going to do things. But the tone of a developer evangelist, you know, when they're external facing or maybe internal facing, also is more of a enticing type of message of, you know, here, let me help you make this easier. Let me show you how valuable this thing is that you could be doing instead, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key, I was just gonna say real quick, I think the key required skill there is empathy. That's a huge right. part of the role, is just being a developer yourself and just recognizing the challenges that other developers face and saying like, I get it. Like, I've been there. Let me help you. Right. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, no, you're going to use EJB 2.0, not Spring Framework. Right. Like that just doesn't fly as much because people are just going to go do their own thing or they're going to quit your company. And that's also really bad, especially where you have a competitive job market. I'm sorry, David, what were you going to say?
Yeah, so I really like what you say when you keep talking about the kind of content that you're publishing. You're focused on value. So you deliver value constantly. You are more interested in being sure that the reader is going to benefit from this article. And I find that like modern marketing, I mean, is exactly the way that we position ourselves. I mean, every new modern company is going to do that way. And even a personal coach, a public figure is always the first thing is going to do is going to give value. And the rule that is now almost a golden rule in social media is that you give, but eventually you're going to get something good. I mean, something good happens. It is not bad that you have a call to action here and there, but most of the content is value. And I find that such a good evolution of strategy in marketing in general. And I argue that this is marketing, but it's healthy marketing. Is we are telling the people how about our product, but not being salesy. It's just helping people. I like that so much.
Yeah, and whether it is content or just being at a hackathon trying to help a developer, you know, whatever the specific tactic is, it is about education and helping and having the empathy for the challenges that particularly for developers that they face. And that's why actually, like, you can kind of tell the companies that do it well and the companies that don't do it well. Because as much as I'm talking about, you know, having empathy for developers and being a developer yourself so you can help other developers, some companies don't do that. They just hire marketers and they, you know, as a developer, like it's like it's like Uncanny Valley. Like they keep talking about their solution to a problem, and you're like, I don't have that problem. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, right? Whoa. Or that solution's not going to work. Like, what are you talking about? Like, so that's I think where you can tell the difference between companies that do it well and companies that don't do it well.
Well, I will go a step further and say that we are experiencing a new ecosystem, a new balance between offer and demand between companies and software developers. And I mean, we really spend a lot of time interviewing and hunting good software developers for American companies. And something that we're experiencing is in a rightful and justifiable way, software developers, candidates, or someone that's going to be interested in working for your company are going to look at the content you produce for the benefit of the software developer inside the company and any other software developer that wants to work for that company. So even though the topic you're talking is specifically about a product that has an API that the primary final user is a software developer, in general, all the things that you have said are becoming a necessity for the new enterprise, I think. It's somehow being open about what they have inside and telling, hey, look, all the things, all the cool things that we have, all the cool things that, I mean, that that effort of marketing not only focused to capturing new clients, but also capturing new developers. That's why I'm so fascinated by this concept. How do you think about that?
I do agree to a large extent that a lot of it has to do with the fact that software developers, when employed properly, can create so much value for a business that you just want to set them up for success, right? And that has not necessarily been the history of enterprise IT, particularly sort of in the early aughts or whatever you call that era, right? It was very much like you're kind of a butt in a seat for at these really large companies. And I think a lot of companies have evolved to recognize, like, you know, if a software developer costs you, you know, $100,000 in salary, and they only create $50,000 worth of value to your business, like, that's just not going to work. Especially when other companies with the right sort of setup and business model are able to create $5 million
right.
Worth of value out of a single developer, and maybe pay them, five times the amount of money because it's totally worth it for them to do that, right? So I think that is a little bit of the evolution of kind of like the IT industry and software developers. And then I think some of the developer relations is associated with that, where it's like, hey, like, if you're a developer, your time is really valuable. And so sometimes you're going to use, first off, open source software, because it's already been created and you could read the code and you know the author of the package and, you know it's well vetted and you can immediately install it, test it out, but also APIs, which, you know, can do things that a lot of open source packages often can't. They're either self-hosted, they take care of the reliability, or in Twilio's situation, like, you know, we have contractual relationships with all the carriers around the world, telecommunications carriers, which no solo developer is going to go make a contractual relationship with, Japanese telecommunications carrier. So, like, that type of thing is just saving a developer time. It's also saving the business time because they can just tap into something that's already been created for, you know, just an incremental amount of money. That is clearly like worth the time that they've invested in. So yeah, I mean, I do think a lot of this stuff is like sort of interrelated in some of the evolution of the trends.
And what about the internal developers? I mean, that if we're in an enterprise and we have a decent amount of developers and we have already some years in the market, so we have some justified complexity in the code, and we have libraries already that we use internally. I mean, this concept applies as well internally still. I mean, but that shows that you care about the developers, right? I mean, I think it's a very powerful concept, I think. I mean, that's why I'm so fascinated by this conversation, because it's something, a new way of thinking about developers. I mean, this is about, let's think about developers, developers first approach. I like that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I honestly, like, you know, certainly empowering developers is a huge part of the way that you operate in developer relations. And frankly, like, I get it partially because, like, I've been a developer in some pretty crummy, you know, situations, death march projects where you're working 80, 90 hours a week and for weeks on end. And I mean, my first job out of college, I worked like a 20-hour day from 7:30 in the morning till 3:30. And that was like pretty typical. And you know, you get no credit for if things break, you get, you know, the project manager throws you under the bus. And if you do a great job, like, nobody really cares. You're like, well, you're getting paid to do that, right? So like recognizing that, like, actually software developers are creative problem solvers. And if you empower them in the right way, they will generate so much more value for your business than treating them terribly or, you know, just saying like, hey, we already wrote the requirements document for you. Here's the best solution to the problem, which is like often not the case, right? These are interwoven trends. Like when you treat developers well, you empower them, you hire really smart people that solve problems, like, you're good things will come out of that as long as you have sort of the right business to take advantage of that. Now a lot of companies don't have the right business, right? Like they are unable to do that. And but even so, like those developers, the good ones of their company will potentially leave because they're like, well, I can't generate enough value for this company here. I'm going to go someplace else where I can get paid double, but I can generate 10 times the amount of value, right? Because the company is just better set up. So yeah, I mean, it's interwoven with developer relations and just recognizing that like we do our best work. Developer relations folks do their best work when they're empowering developers. They're treating them with respect, just like everyone wants to be treated with respect. But in particular, the folks that, you know, for a long time, I think were treated as if, you know, they didn't really matter, even though they were the ones who were trying to, you know, get these systems online.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting point you bring up, David, because I think a little like parallel to how developer relations matter in, you know, business we have. And, you know, in Agility Feet, we do staff augmentation, but in our other brand, which Matt also knows, and is WebRTC Ventures, where we're building video applications. And an important part of our work there and how we sell ourselves as a company is through content marketing, right? We don't have an API that we're selling anybody. We're using other APIs like Twilio's. But we market ourselves through content marketing, and that obviously helps us get clients in that business. But I think it does also help us in recruiting, because when we're talking to a developer that we want to hire, if they're looking at our blog or other places that we've written content, they get to see the interesting type of work that they can do with us, and they get to see maybe some of the people they're going to work with and get excited about working with those people. So I think that's an interesting, you know, a lot of these concepts in an API focused company like Twilio and how you would hire for developer relations can also be really useful in thinking about how you might hire either marketing focused engineers or just senior engineers in your team who need to help train up others in your organization also as your team is growing, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think knowing, like there's been many times where I've actually read the technical works of my future colleagues, and like it's come up in interviews and stuff like that. And or it's like I read a blog post, you know, there's only about 22 to 24 million software developers worldwide, about 6 million in the US. About 10, I mean, I don't know how much it's changed over the past couple of years, but about 10% of that has been in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. So it's like you have these concentrated pockets of developers. And so, you know, the ones that really stand out with their writing, their thinking in a clear, cogent way, like, and especially if it, you know, kind of pops on Hacker News or on Reddit or on Twitter, like a bunch of these, you know, or whatever other sources people read, like it does stand out. Like if you know, you may find that you work with someone like that. My colleague, Greg Bogus, who's at Twilio, he wrote this post that was on Hacker News, like top of Hacker News in 2013. It was called, it was in 2013. It was called The Auto Workers of Our Generation, and kind of an interesting like philosophical comparison between, you know, the auto workers for the big three decades ago and how software developers, you know, have sort of good jobs, and it's a ticket to sort of an upper middle class situation and stuff. And just kind of the parallels it was really fascinating. And then like, he's my colleague, like a few months later, and it was like, that was an awesome post, right? Like that type of stuff, like it does happen quite a bit. And it doesn't always have to be like a philosophical thing. It might be just a really great technical tutorial. I don't know. I like another great example is like, Miguel Grinberg, is one of my colleagues, and he wrote the Flask book for O'Reilly, and he wrote the Flask mega tutorial. And I read, you know, I learned Flask through his mega tutorial years before we actually were colleagues. That's a really cool situation when you know, have such a strong, you learn so much from someone before you ever, you know, interacted with them at your company.
And this is taking me to another topic, which is content creation, but from the developer benefit, I mean, from the perspective of a single developer taking care of his own career. Like, I mean, it is amazing sometimes finding someone that is so brilliant, but is not happy with the work he does and is not in the best company he could be. And I'm pretty sure the reason is that person is not writing. is not creating content, he's not making himself available to the world. He's not giving value to a community, producing videos, making projects available, and explaining code in GitHub. That is strategy. It just works. It not only works for you and our companies, it works from the perspective of the sole benefit of the developer by himself. I think I think it's a good advice to anyone. I believe.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something you want to be intentional about, right? Right. It works at certain points in your career. But you know, people have lives outside of work, and some folks don't want to make it their life. Mm-hmm. And that is totally, totally fine. More than fine as well. But I agree. Like sometimes, you know, if you're like, I'll give you an example. Like when I was a Java developer, you know, pretty traditional J2E, you know, doing some contracting for Department of Defense, like I would just go home at night and like taught myself Python, and I just loved it. It was great. Like I felt so productive in it. And that was a period of my life where I didn't have like a, you know, a wife or a kid and stuff like that. So I was able to do that. Right. And I was able to write things. And sometimes that really can help you get out of a rut. But other times that's just not, you know, what you want to do with your career. So yeah, I mean, I think it's always something you want to be intentional about, like, oh, should I invest in a certain way, in myself, in my career, or is that just not something? Like, it's also totally fine to be like, that's not really what I want to do right now.
And at the same time, this is a long game. I mean, anything related to content is for results that you expect to have, like midterm, long term in your life. It's not immediate anyway.
I mean, I don't know. It really depends on kind of what your goals are, right? Like sometimes you just have that creative burst of energy for 6 months, and you're like, I just want to explain things. I want to write that, like, or you know, you're struggling at work with some concept, and you just really want to dig into it fully. And there's not necessarily a greater reason, but just putting your thoughts down on a blog is the best way to really learn a subject. So I don't know. But I think it always comes down to intentionality and your own goals. And just, mm-hmm. I think that when people get upset, or frustrated with kind of their situation, it's because they haven't been like, ask themselves what they really want. And if you ask yourself what you want, and the answer is like, I don't want to do any of that stuff. That's fine. At least you've asked mm-hmm. yourself, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, I just want to have a 9-to-5 job. Okay. That's totally cool too. Right.
Right. Yeah. But be intentional.
Like, but yeah. You're intentional about it. You're like, yeah, right. You're not like, oh, I should have done X, Y, and right, Z. Right. And it's 10 years later. And you're like, oh, if only I had at least asked myself what I wanted to get out of all of this. That's, I think, where people can often run into some.
So certainly somebody can be a great developer without also being a great writer or, you know,
definitely.
Communicator necessarily. Certainly, you know, we've all known plenty of developers in that category. But if someone does, you know, if you're hiring for these developer relations roles, I mean, if somebody has a lot of obvious public experience, that's one thing. But if someone is new to that role, doesn't have that obvious public experience, how do you hire for that? How do you tell if, I mean, can you, maybe a question I'm trying to ask here is, can you teach a great developer to write well? Or do they have to have that already? Do they have to have that innate desire and communication ability in them, and how do you assess that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll say that there's a few factors here. One is you have to have the technical credibility. So, you know, let's say you've never written anything before. Like if you have the technical credibility, right? Like you have sort of that primordial goo that allows you to build something on top of it or something. I don't know. It's probably like a terrible analogy. You know, it's like the foundation, right? Like you can't be a great, you can't do create great Java tutorials if you've never programmed in Java before. Like you have to have the technical credibility. I do think you have to have a natural curiosity, which fortunately, like kind of most developers do. And that natural curiosity tends to sort of like ooze out into other places in your life. Like some developers are really musically inclined. Some of them like woodworking. I've been doing a lot of Legos with my 4-year-old. I love it. You know, like that natural sort of curiosity. And a lot of times it bleeds out into writing. So if it kind of goes in that direction for writing, like, no, you don't have to get permission from anybody to set up your own blog and start writing about technical subjects. You can just kind of put them out there, or you can put them out there and then ask people for feedback. I do think that, like, there's kind of a non-negotiable attribute. And it's humility. I don't think you can be a great developer without humility, or a great developer relations person with humility. Like, I've always found that, like, the more I learn, like, the less I know. And just humility, I think, does go hand in hand with the empathy. Doesn't mean that you're not confident about things. Like, I'm a good developer. Like, I've been programming, like, for decades, you know, but there's a lot I don't know. And every time I talk to another developer, there's things that they know that I don't. And I think just recognizing that, I think, you know, the humility, some developers' lack of humility comes from, I think, just the insecurity, of, you know, their own knowledge. But I think for the folks that are the best, they take that insecurity and turn it actually into a bit of curiosity and humility and empathy for others. So that's the main thing, is, like, there's no, we very much screen for, empathy, humility, and obviously you have to have the technical credibility. That's kind of step one.
Love it.
Yeah. Those are the key bits. There's a few others, but those are I'd say the key bits. And I think you can teach the writing as long as someone wants to be taught.
Okay. I'd like to change subjects a little bit as we start to near the end of our time here and hear a little bit more about full stack Python and the work that you did there, because I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of how you, one of your first forays anyways, into public content development. And so I'd love to hear about, you know, what has it's 10 years or something now running full stack Python taught you about developing in Python, and maybe life in general, your career in general.
Yeah, sure. So I created full stack Python in 2012. So yeah, it's almost been, at the end of this year, it'll have been 10 full years. It's fullstackpython.com. Really, it was, the name came from, like, it was an available domain, and full stack developers were kind of just first becoming, you know, something that people were kind of talking about. I certainly was a full stack developer. Like, I was going, you know, writing SQL queries and stored procedures and stuff like that. And then all the way up to JavaScript, it was still, you know, pre sort of JavaScript MVC days. But it was still, you know, JavaScript in the front end. Thank goodness for jQuery. People don't like it anymore, but I still very much appreciate it. It is much better than what came before it. So I just started, like, I don't know. I think it was like I had a Christmas break or something like that, where I had a couple weeks off, and I was like, I just want to, I learned a lot from the Python community, particularly, like, Hitchhiker's Guide to Python and several other sites, that were really, great at the time. I just thought, like, I think I have a little bit of a different spin on it. And mostly it was about deployment at the time, because I was doing a lot of Python deployments. It wasn't a ton about, what's called the web server gateway interface, WSGI, and how you handle that with, you know, particularly, like, Nginx was still, still relatively uncommon. I feel like it was really taking off, but, like, you know, using that as a web server and reverse proxy, like, a lot of this stuff was, like, still, I wouldn't say it was, like, totally nascent, but it wasn't widely adopted like it is today. And so I was just like, I'm just going to write about this stuff. I used a framework called Pelican, which is a static website generator, still powers my site. I think it was on GitHub Pages to start. It's now hosted off S3 with Cloudflare in front of it. It's read by about, like, I think it's like 200,000 developers or something a month. Although, you know, analytics are hard. So there's probably, like, a big range between, you know, a lot of people block Google Analytics. I look at Cloudflare. It's actually, like, really hard to measure these things now, but it's, you know, it's somewhere up there. I will say that also, like, I worked on it every single day for, you know, many years, taking a little bit of a break from it now, because I've had another side project that's really been exciting to me. And the one challenge with full stack Python is it's more writing than it is developing. And particularly now that I am very sadly a manager of managers, I want the development time more than I want more time to write. Because I certainly spend a lot of time writing at work as well. So I tend to not work on full stack Python as much. And it definitely has in some places fallen out of date. I plan to like go back and update all the pages that are out there. But I've just got like another side project, which is called PlushCap. It's plushcap.com, which is like a Django application hosted on a DigitalOcean droplet with Cloudflare in front. I love Cloudflare. I've been a customer of theirs for like years. I own some of their stock, which has gone up and really down. Should have sold at the peak, like everything else in the market.
Yeah, exactly. Bad week to be talking about.
I tend to buy like all the stocks, like especially after IPO, like companies I've been like, if I've been a customer of like DigitalOcean, Cloudflare, you know, if I've been a customer of like for 5+ years of a company and I love them, like why would I not buy some of their stock? Like, it just seems like a good bet. And plus, if you're like suddenly unhappy with their service, you're like, I'm going to sell your stock. And then I feel like I've done something against what you did to me. I don't know.
It's better than a bad Yelp review.
Yeah, exactly. anyway, yeah, so I have this thing called PlushCap, and it's actually like looking at the content that developer-focused companies with a self-service motion, which means you can sign up, you're on not a talk-to-sales motion, what content they create. Because I just find it really interesting to like analyze. I basically take the web, what's on their public facing website. I kind of do a bunch of data analysis on it and then, kind of visualize that. And just like a really fun side project, use Bokeh, which is a Python project for, visualizing data. You know, some pandas, it's a Django application. So it just allows me to like have a really great excuse for, you know, doing a lot of coding on the nights and weekends. You gotta kind of have that if you don't scratch that itch enough, as a developer.
Yeah. So as a manager of managers now, which I can appreciate, is that kind of the best way to sort of keep your skills fresh then is through some sort of side project like that, or are you able to still work that into the job at all?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very helpful. Cause you get to just choose what you want to, you know, do with it. I do think that, you know, I do quite a bit of data analysis. Like one of the advantages I still have trouble saying this, like being a developer in a marketing organization, is marketing has a crazy amount of data. Like, honestly, I think most marketing, well-run marketing, organizations have more data and are more data driven than engineering organizations. I mean, maybe some people will find that controversial, but I actually think that a lot of engineering organizations, except for like the monitoring and alerting side of things, tend to be more like astrologers than, you know, like than really actually data driven. Like there's so many trends. Like, do you really need to rewrite your front end in, you know, whatever the latest JavaScript MVC? Like I saw this joke that was like, oh, I feel so productive. I just rewrote my Backbone application to do the same thing in Angular. And I feel really productive because I did that. It's like, literally you created, like it was nothing different about like for the end user. Like it might be a fun project, but it's not valuable to a business necessarily, right, in most cases to do that. So,
Matt, do you have any advice? I mean, I have a classical advice when someone wants to start writing, which is, don't sit down and expect to commit an act of masterpiece creation. I mean, if you really want to do that, that will never happen. I mean, you will never end, but you will never start, do you think? That's my classic. But do you have something specific so someone can start writing and producing content as a software developer?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone is different. So, you know, my advice works for me. I say you need to do it every day, because if you don't do it every day, what you'll find is that, you know, a week goes by and then you feel guilt that you didn't do it. And then you feel behind and then it's stressful and you're not enjoying it. Whereas like with full stack Python, the reason why I did it every single day for many, many years was I sometimes work for 5 minutes. I'd rewrite a sentence. I don't even create anything new. I just rewrite a sentence. I'm like, this is not the most clear. I'm going to rewrite it. And then sometimes what you'd find is like 2 hours later, I've like written a whole new section on the site about something. But other days I'd be like, that was good enough. I'll push this live. Like I did something, right? You just don't know how you're going to feel that day until you actually do it. It's like when it's all just up here and you're like, oh yeah, today I'm going to be productive. But if you never start, you're not going to be productive. You'll never know whether you were productive that day or not, right? Like it's, so for me, it's doing it every day. But for other people, I'm sure it's probably like, I don't know. There's all sorts of different, like, I think it's like knowing yourself to some extent. It's like, I'm sure for some people, it's like maybe you have a separate desk and you just go sit at that, like you set a timer and you sit at that desk every day at 4 p.m. You carve out a block on your schedule. I think that works for some people. You're like, oh, I'm going to set a standing meeting at 4 p.m. for a half hour. I'm just going to write, and some of it's going to be crap. Some of it will be good. But I'm just going to do it, right? Like, or you do it like once a week or something like that. I don't know. Everyone's kind of different with this stuff, but that's what works for me. I'm sure it works for a subset of people, but not others.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, I do think that once you write regularly, though, you probably know, you often get a very good feel for when something actually is, maybe not like a masterpiece, but like, I can definitely tell, like, if I'm writing something, I'm like, I think this will blow up on Hacker News. Like I read things and be like, this is something that will, with like 80% certainty, be of interest to that audience. And it's not because you're a master writer, but because you know your audience, right? Like that's so much of what it is. Like you know how that audience thinks, you know what they're interested in. And you have like a little bit of a different spin that's going to get their brain kind of like, you know, just enough interested that they're like thinking about it. And then they're going to like throw you that upvote because they thought it was valuable to read your thing.
Awesome. Awesome. David, any final questions on your part before we wrap up?
No, I'm happy to be here and hearing all this experience. So thank you, Matt, for being with us. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much, Matt. This has really been great. I feel like there's so much more we could have gotten to, and so maybe we can have you back in another time to talk more about Python or learn more about PlushCap or developer relations in general. And I think this has really been a mind-bending conversation for me in terms of really thinking about how much of this applies outside of really just in hiring tech people in general. Not to say everybody has to be a great writer, but certainly, some of the comments like you made about the importance of empathy and humility, I think is so important and goes way beyond a developer relations role too, just a good teammate role. But I really appreciate, your thoughts on how you all hire for that. So thanks so much for joining us, Matt. Any other, how can people follow up with you? Any other kind of comments you want to put in before we wrap up here?
I am Matt McKay on Twitter and GitHub. I guess that, I do actually check Twitter quite a bit. I'm not like that prolific on writing tweets, but I retweet a lot. I do like chat with people on there. So that's probably the best way. And then I'm guessing there's like a bunch of, well, I'll give you some links and stuff like that. There's an article recently on developer content for product-led growth that was I worked with our former chief marketing officer on. That's probably interesting to people who found this conversation interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It was published up on decibel.vc. It's a great article. I saw that myself, and we'll definitely include that in the show notes for this episode. Thanks again for joining us, Matt. And for those, thanks to all of you watching and listening to this episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast. And check us out at scalingtechpod.com for the show notes from this episode and all of our episodes. Thanks so much for joining us today, Matt.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by agilityfeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.